So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good to see old friends and new ones. Thank you for coming out this morning. Beautiful spring day, even though it's going to rain a little bit later on, I hear. Well, today I thought I'd like to talk a little bit about creating a ground for meditation practice. And this came out of an experience I had two Fridays ago. And I gave an hour and a half meditation mindfulness workshop to a group of employees at HSBC Bank downtown. My first adventure into the corporate world. Apparently, an employee at the bank had surfed the net and looking for someone to come in and give a talk and lead a group a little bit, and found Mountain Rain. And then contacted Kate. And after a bit of back and forth emailing with Kate, we decided that that I would lead a mindfulness and meditation session for the bank. And it went fairly well. You know, an hour and a half, most people had no experience at all of meditation practice, you can imagine. But the group was made up of about 20 or so auditors. I don't even know quite what an auditor does at a bank, but I guess they audit, right, stuff. And with four or five of them beaming in from Toronto. So the room, kind of the, you know, typical office meeting room with this huge screen with five heads facing me, and then everyone else kind of sitting, at least kind of in a kind of a circle. And they wanted to something to help with stress. So the theme was dealing with stress. So as part of the session, I asked them to highlight what was most stressful in their lives right now. And their answers were, as you might expect, with much overlap, but things like stress around aging and distant parents, stress around their young children, their teenagers, finding their feet in the new job that they recently are in now, trying to buy a house, being constantly in a rush, feeling work pressure, and fear of not being adequate. You experience any of that kind of stuff? And a couple, though, quite interesting, replied, nothing particular at this time. I talked to the one guy afterwards, and he said, yeah, I'm retiring in 2 months. I don't have any stress at the moment. And but several of them also said everything. That life seemed nothing but stress for them right now. So I thought, such is the life of a well-paid professional, at least in this world. And really, you know, I think a number of them participated in this because it was mandated as a group activity, a kind of a bonding activity. And given the choice, I'm sure a number of them would have rather spent their time kind of catching up, doing some other work-related items. And so ironically, the workshop for them simply became another source of stress when they could have been spending their time doing something else. But as I said, you know, the workshop went fairly well. And thinking about the workshop afterwards, it occurred to me that, of course, most of them, and I think probably most of us, tend to look for the quick fix as something that will make this anxious and frantic life a little more livable. And certainly the mindfulness materials that I've read about online and in articles really tout that mindfulness and meditation as a possible but temporary antidote to our chronic stress and source of unease. And while it may help, as will running regularly, perhaps a few drinks after a busy day, Xanax and Ativan will also help. Isn't it odd that we seldom really investigate the roots of our fearfulness, or our roots of our sense of urgency that permeate our life? It seems to me there is a shared and largely unquestioned acceptance of modernity as it is. A life focused on the future rather than the present. A life largely disconnected from others. And a life that seems to always be simmering with tension. And while we, of course, pay lip service to wanting things to be different, the social pressure to just keep up and cope with the status quo is always there. And also we're conditioned, right? Conditioned by the many agents of advertising to believe the problems of our life can be healed with a few tweaks or by consuming more. So we try out this and that in the hope of finding something that will bring ease and groundedness, or at least a bit of longer relief. And some of these are effective, right? Yoga in its many forms, Pilates, Pilates, something called Couch to 5K, which I don't know what that is, spinning, and also something called Body by Jake. And these are some of the things I just found on the internet. And then there's, you know, the kind of non-body focused stuff like progressive relaxation, aromatherapy, biofeedback, guided visualization, float tanks, oxygen bars, pot, and of course, mindfulness workshops. And meditation is part of this list, thanks in part to the kind of mountain of research that's being done now in meditation. And so it seems easy to assume that by adding 20 or 30 minutes a day to our daily schedule by doing meditation, we'll overcome much of the anxiety and stress and of this hectic and troubled life. And again, while that may be true to some extent, meditation used as simply another temporary way to mitigate our suffering will not transform. Nor will it open us to the wholeness of our life. Meditation in the Buddhist tradition, and especially in the Zen tradition, I think, is a deep questioning of our assumptions and our habitual way of thinking and acting. It is partly turning awareness on the anxious and hectic stories that we're caught in, questioning the roots of those stories and opening up to a wider understanding of this life. And it's also a way that we clarify our values and a way we engage with our shadow side, to use a Jungian term there. To engage deeply in meditation practice, to really have it permeate our life, I think takes more than just 20 or 30 minutes a day. It requires that we cultivate the ground for the meditation practice. And this is the reason that at Deer Park, all those many centuries ago, when the Buddha, in his first sermon after his awakening, he did not discuss the ins and outs of meditation practice. He didn't give an hour and a half workshop on how to be mindful. He taught the Four Noble Truths: the existence of dissatisfaction, the cause of dissatisfaction, that that cause can come to an end, and the path that leads to the end of dissatisfaction. And that path that he then detailed that leads to the end of dissatisfaction is known as the Eightfold Path. And while meditation, of course, is part of that, there are seven other factors. Clearly, you know, from the time of the Buddha, leading a moral or ethical life has been emphasized as a way to nurture the ground of a meditation practice. And this may seem obvious. A cruel or heartless person will struggle with developing a focused and clear meditation practice. And one reason the early Buddhist texts give for this, and for and therefore for acting ethically, is that the strong self-focused emotions really assert and calcify a sense of self. The idea of me against the world, me and the rest of the world. So when we indulge in anger, give in to greed, maybe lying to get what you want, for example, all of this fosters a focus on the self, on self-centeredness. And the practice of virtue, of non-harming, truthfulness, sobriety, for example, these help create the ground for meditation practice because these qualities nurture what the Buddhist texts call blamelessness. And I would say nurture a sense of ease. And they do this in two ways. One, I'm not trying to justify my actions. Right? I told a lie because blah, 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 blah. Right? I deserve blah, blah, blah. So we're not trying to justify our actions. And also, we're not facing recriminations from others. Make sense? So in our tradition, these qualities, this practice of virtue, is encapsulated, of course, in the Bodhisattva precepts. These guidelines to help us step back from what tend to be our self-centered views into a wider and more comprehensive and maybe more compassionate perspective of life. And so to help us remember our commitment to an ethical life, we chant the precepts every full moon, just like we did last Wednesday, and recommit to this way of conduct over and over again, because it's so easy to forget. And these precepts, as we've said many times, are not absolute rules by any means. And they're not commandments, as we see in the Old Testament, for example. They're more, I think, like promises or vows, encouragements to ourselves to act in wholesome ways. In a way, I think precepts are our protection against our own lesser nature. In other words, our way of reacting to the world based on me, on a me focus, rather than responding from a more compassionate and encompassing perspective. Our commitment to the precepts aids us to resist unwholesome urges like harming another, taking what's not ours, engaging in inappropriate sexual relationships. They protect us from causing harm to ourselves and to others. a clear conscience. A clear conscience is one ground for meditation practice. Another way to put this is we create an environment that's safer, not so buffeted by our own whims and urges. And in that environment, our heart is calmer, less troubled by self-criticism or rationalizations. But there's another benefit, I think, to this ethical life. When we embrace the precepts, for example, they foster in us an attitude of generosity, of giving. And most of us come to meditation practice with an attitude to get something. And that's natural. Living a life aligned with the precepts, giving these precepts to ourselves and others, truth, non-harming, clarity of mind, honesty, respectful actions, we become ever more aware of the power of giving, the power of generosity. And what is the power of generosity? It connects us to others. And it also loosens our firm grip that we have on ourselves. At some point, it dawns on us that meditation practice is not just for my own sake. It's not just to calm the stormy seas that are inside. But it is for all of those around us as well. And when we open to that, our motivation to practice deepens. So one ground is establishing ourselves in virtue, in the Bodhisattva precepts. And then we should also consider restraining our senses. In the Eightfold Path, the Buddha talks about right effort. And right effort is our conscious intention to prevent harmful and unwholesome states of mind from arising. And if they do arise, then to not nurture them, but try to end them. And this is not being guilty when, I don't know, lust or anger or something like that arises in us. It's really about taking responsibility and not indulging them. Bringing our awareness to our body sensations, to the breath, for example, or practicing loving kindness meditations for oneself or others can help when we're caught in some kind of unwholesome state of mind. And right effort also means to actually reach out and cultivate wholesome states of mind. Remembering, for example, the positive and good qualities of someone you're pissed off with. Remembering your own good qualities. When you're angry about yourself. Nurturing thoughts of generosity, loving kindness, and compassion. There's a wonderful Buddhist practice of giving everything away. Like when you go outside and you see the flowering trees, you can give them to your friend. I give you these beautiful flowering trees. I give you these clouds. That's what it's meant, to give everything away. It doesn't literally mean the clothes off your back, although maybe someday that would be appropriate, but you can give lots of things away. But in our time, particularly, I think we need to be thoughtful about our media consumption as well. Avoiding that which gives rise to greed and anger and confusion, and noticing what inspires and what gives us insight. The Buddha put it this way in one of the early texts. He wrote or said, "There is devotion to the indulgence of sense pleasures, which is low, common, the way of ordinary people, unworthy and unprofitable. And there is devotion to self-mortification, which is painful, unworthy, and unprofitable." Right? Both not so good. And he goes on, "Avoiding both these extremes, the Buddha has realized the middle path. It gives vision, it gives knowledge, and it leads to calm, to insight, to awakening." So the Buddha is asking us to be skillful in how we respond to the world and what we take in. Mortification, which was very common at the time of the Buddha, right? To deny food, to fast incredible lengths of time, do strange body postures for very long periods of time. The Buddha said, well, that's not the answer. That's not going to be helpful. And neither is kind of mindless indulging in our senses and desires. Because in a way, he experienced both, according to the mythic origins that we have and understand today. You know, he grew up in a palace. You know, musicians playing music all the time, two palaces, one a bit warm, one a bit cool, depending on the season, dancing girls, goes on and on, right? But that's not the answer either. Although, don't we tend to think of it, you know, if only a little more money, a little bigger house, a little something. At any rate, through this kind of middle way of limiting ourselves a little, checking in, is this really wholesome or not? We cultivate a stable ground for our meditation practice. In other words, our mind then is not filled with distracting stuff, but already is in a place of clarity that then we nurture in our practice. Our ancient ancestors didn't have streaming. They didn't have the multi-channel universe, Facebook or Twitter. We each need to answer for ourselves how to handle these powerful sources of information and these powerful sources of distraction. And sometimes I ask myself, what is being fed here? And I ask myself, is this the Michael that needs soothing and some distraction? Or is this the Michael that is simply caught in a display of violence, power, or titillation? Or just mindless Michael? And quite often, I don't like the answer, frankly. Am I learning? Or are my own entrenched views simply growing stronger by looking at this, by reading this? The media is a slippery place for us all, and a dangerous one too, because we're all subject to manipulation. It takes effort, and it takes remembering. I think we need to be aware of what we watch and listen to, what we read, with the intention not to fill our minds with what is harmful and unwholesome. And only you can do that. Only you can do that by asking yourself, is this really helpful? Is this harmful? So we need to ask ourselves, how will I restrain my senses so that my mind is not agitated and distracted? But perhaps, given these two things are important, though, perhaps creating a good ground for meditation practice really begins with the first item of the Eightfold Path, which is often translated as right view. Now, right view, I don't think, is a very good translation, because we assume then that there's wrong views, right? If there's right view, there's got to be a wrong one, a correct one. But that's not what's meant here. The term in Sanskrit is samyak drishti. And samyak means full or complete. And drishti means a perspective, a full perspective, a complete perspective. So we can understand this as a view that encompasses our whole life. The view, because it encompasses our whole life, the view that guides our actions and decisions. So right view is not presenting a kind of dogmatic list of things, a way of looking at the world, a way how we should respond to the world. Rather, it's pointing out that there are views that will lead to the end of dissatisfaction. There are ways of seeing the world that will lessen our suffering. So right view is about each of us developing a clear and sound understanding of life by becoming aware of what we think. And then to inquire more deeply into why we think what we think. It is about clarity. And part of this practice of right view is acknowledging the results of heedlessness when we act unskillfully and, of course, suffer the consequences. For example, perhaps questioning our tendency to blame others rather than examining our own role and perhaps refusing to take responsibility. And the other part is seeing for oneself the veracity, the truth of the Buddhist teachings. How does craving and aversion touch me? How does it twist me? What brings calm and insight in my life? What nurtures compassion and equanimity for myself and for others? How shall I live in this world of profound impermanence? This is what right view is about. It's about inquiry, and a kind of inquiry that helps to lift the fog of unconsciously held opinions and assumptions. And this lays the ground for a fruitful meditation practice. You know, I was just thinking one of the clearest examples of this is the kind of entrenched views that we see in the political scene right now, in particularly in the United States, but also other places in the world. You know, so black and white. So black and white. Now, there are many practical things we can do to support our meditation practice, and I'm not focusing on those today, but you know, having a regular space, a regular time, sitting with others, checking in with the teacher now and again, avoiding judging your meditation session, scale 1 to 10. Oh, that was a 6. Maybe a 6.5 today. Don't do that. And I think it can also help when you, at the end of your meditation practice, dedicate the merit, the benefit of it to others. So there's lots of practical things, that's just a few. However, returning again and again to your commitment to a moral life, practicing a wholesome restraint, and deepening right view will create a good ground for meditation practice. And this ground will allow the meditation practice to permeate your life. In this way, your practice will open up and transform the world beyond you. It will transform you too, but it goes beyond you. Now, if you've practiced for a while, you all know this stuff that I've been talking about. This is nothing new. And I apologize for stating the obvious. Creating a ground for a sincere meditation practice is not exotic and it's not fancy. But it is easy to forget our intentions. You and I must return again and again to our commitment to live a full and true life, a life of benefit, a life of insight, of compassion, a life that brings forward our values, however you articulate them. So I'd like to suggest, like over the next week, let's ask a couple of questions. What will I give this troubled world? And how can I make my imperfect offering? What will I give this troubled world? And how can I make my imperfect offering? Well, thank you. Maybe.